Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. In the first years of the United States, many Americans spoke German, Hebrew, Latin, or English influenced by British history and literature. But one teacher believed the new nation needed its own language. For American English learners, Noah Webster may be the most important figure in U.S. history. Dr. Jill Robbins has more.
Some people collect stamps. Others collect coins. Noah Webster Jr. collected words. He did not save just the words, of course, but also their meanings and spellings. His collection became the basis of today's American English. Webster was born October 16, 1758, on a farm in West Hartford, Connecticut. His family came from the early European colonists of Massachusetts and Connecticut. Webster was interested in language even as a child. He learned to read before he started school. Most children at the time stopped their education after only a few years. But Webster continued his. He attended college at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. During the 4 years Webster studied at Yale, the American colonies separated from Britain in the Revolutionary War. People at the time argued about the language of the newly independent states. Should it be English or German? After all, 10% of the population spoke German. Others said Hebrew should be the common language. Many schools taught Hebrew so students could read the original Judeo-Christian Bible. Webster thought the language of the American states should be English, but not British English, American English. The only problem was that such a language did not yet formally exist. People in different American states used different words, different spellings, and different pronunciations. By this time, Webster was a teacher. Most schools taught Latin, and students wrote or made oral presentations in Latin. But Webster argued that it was more practical for merchants, mechanics, planners, etc., to know their own language well. If they learned another language, he said, it should be a living language, such as French, Italian, Spanish, or German. Webster believed improving children's education could help build a stronger nation. In an essay, Webster wrote that Americans should study other countries' histories and governments. That way, Americans could avoid mistakes, advance the sciences, and add dignity to the United States and human nature. Young Americans should also learn to use a standard and pure language, Webster said. So he decided to write a series of textbooks, a speller, a reader, and a grammar. Webster published the first book, which came to be called The Blueback Speller, in 1783. Webster worked hard to promote the book. He invented the modern book tour. He traveled around the country, bringing books to his public speeches. The speller immediately became a bestseller. Soon, it was used in schools in every state. In 1787, Webster changed the book's name to The American Spelling Book. An important part of the method Webster taught for spelling was to divide a word into its sounds or syllables. Thomas Dilworth's British Spelling Books said that people should pronounce T-I before a vowel as a separate syllable. That rule made them say nation as nation and motion as motion. Webster thought the correct pronunciation was nation and motion. Webster also thought some British spellings did not make sense. He preferred variations that some Americans were already using. So in his works, he changed music, spelled M-U-S-I-C-K, to music, M-U-S-I-C, and plow, spelled P-L-O-U-G-H, to plow, P-L-O-W. Some of the changes he suggested did not stay, such as changing tongue, spelled T-O-N-G-U-E, to tongue, T-U-N-G, and women, spelled W-O-M-E-N, to women, spelled W-I-M-M-E-N. But many others remained. American writer H.L. Mencken wrote in the early 20th century, "The influence of his speller was really stupendous. It maintained its authority for nearly a century. In the 100 years after the Blueback speller came out, the only book to sell more copies in the U.S. was the Bible. Webster's speller helped unify the written language of the United States. Webster used the money he was able to earn from his speller to begin another project, a dictionary. He believed Americans needed a dictionary that reflected their own geography, political system, and history. His first version, published in 1806, included about 40,000 words. His second, called The American Dictionary of the English Language, included 70,000 words. To create it, Webster learned at least the basics of over 20 languages. He also defined words that were new to American English. Many were borrowed from Native American languages, such as skunk and squash. He also gave the pronunciation of words as Americans said them. One of his definitions showed how proud Webster was of his country. He included a quote from its first leader, George Washington. After the word American, Webster wrote, "A native of America, originally applied to the aboriginals, or copper-colored races, found here by the Europeans, but now applied to the descendants of Europeans born in America. The name American must always exalt the pride of patriotism." Washington. Webster's dictionary came to be a symbol of the country's new national identity. The website ConnecticutHistory.org points out that Webster's efforts also marked the last time one person created a major dictionary alone. A few years after Noah Webster died, at the age of 86, two brothers gained the rights to the American Dictionary. George and Charles Merriam owned a printing and bookselling business. They were able to make, update, and sell the dictionary at a less expensive price than the Webster family had. The reference book became increasingly popular in schools and homes across the U.S. Like Webster's speller, Webster's dictionary became the authority on American English. Not just in the 19th century, but today. For example, If you are reading this article on a computer, point the mouse to any word in the story. You will see a definition from, you guessed it, Merriam-Webster. I'm Jill Robbins.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Agriculture Report. Most kinds of rose plants come from Asia, but roses are also native to other areas, including Northwest Africa, Europe, and the United States. In 1986, the U.S. Congress chose the rose as America's national flower. Technically, Congress and President Ronald Reagan declared it the national floral emblem. Whatever the name, the decision did not smell sweet to lovers of other flowers. Some people say roses are difficult to grow, but you have a good chance of success if you start with a few suggestions from experts. You should plant your roses where they can get sunshine for about 6 hours on bright days. You can buy roses from a garden center or by mail order. You can buy potted roses, also known as container roses, or bare root plants. Each kind has its fans. Some gardeners say potted roses are easier to plant. They say the roots develop better. But Jeffrey Dinslodge, president of Nature Hills Nursery in Omaha, Nebraska, points out that bare root roses come without soil, so they weigh less to transport. The University of Illinois Extension advises getting bare root roses as close to planting time as you can. If they arrive before you are ready to plant them, make sure the packing material is moist. Keep the plants in a cool, dark place. You plant the roses while they are dormant. The resting plants have no leaves, but still need water. When growing roses, the soil should feel moist deep down. Watering should be done in the morning. That can prevent problems called black spot and mildew. But do not water too much. Jeffrey Dinslodge says people often ask him about unhealthy discoloration on rose leaves. He says the spots are usually caused by too much water. After heavy rains or too much watering, he advises pulling away mulch temporarily from around the roots. This will help dry the soil. In normal conditions, placing mulch around rose plants is a good idea. Mulch suppresses weeds and holds moisture in the soil. You can use mulch made from bark, pine needles, cottonseed, or oak leaves. If your soil is very dry, you can add peat or compost, which returns nutrients to the soil. If aphids, thrips, or other insects invade your rose bushes, you may be able to force them off with just a strong spray of water. And that's the Agriculture Report. I'm Mario Ritter. Thank you.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the late 1800s, white Americans expanded their settlements in the western part of the country. They claimed land traditionally used by American Indians. The Indians were hunters, and they struggled to keep control of their hunting lands. The federal government supported the settlers' claims. It fought and won several wars with Indian tribes. It forced the Indians to live on government-controlled reservations. This week in our series, Larry West and Steve Ember tell about the people who settled on the old Indian lands after the wars.
After the Indians were defeated, thousands of settlers hurried west. Some hoped to find new, rich farmland. The soil they left behind was thin and overworked. Their crops were poor. Some simply hoped to buy any kind of farmland. They did not have enough money to buy farmland in the East. Others came from other countries and hoped to build new lives in the United States. All the settlers found it easy to get land in the West. In 1862, Congress had passed the Homestead Act. This law gave every citizen and every foreigner who asked for citizenship the right to claim government land. The law said each man could have 65 hectares. If he built a home on the land and farmed it for 5 years, it would be his. He paid just $10 to record the deal.
Claiming land on the Great Plains was easy. Building a farm there and working it was not so easy. The wide, flat grasslands seemed strange to men who had lived among the hills and forests of the East. Here there were few hills or trees. Without trees, settlers had no wood to build houses. Some built houses partly underground. Others built houses from blocks of earth cut out of the grassland. These houses were dark and dirty. They leaked and became muddy when it rained. There were no fences on the Great Plains, so it was hard to keep animals away from crops.
Settlers in the American West also had a problem faced by many people in the world today. They had little fuel for heating and cooking. With few trees to cut for fuel, they collected whatever they could find. Small woody plants, dried grass, cattle and buffalo wastes. Water was hard to find, too. And although the land seemed rich, it was difficult to prepare for planting. The grass roots were thick and strong. They did not break apart easily. The weather also was a problem. Sometimes months would pass without rain, and the crops would die. Winters were bitterly cold.
Most of the settlers, however, were strong people. They did not expect an easy life. And as time passed, they found solutions to most of the problems of farming on the Great Plains. Railroads were built across the West. They brought wood for homes, wood, and coal for fuel. Technology solved many of the problems. New equipment was invented for digging deep wells. Better pumps were built to raise the water to the surface. Some of the pumps used windmills for power.
The fence problem was solved in 1874. That was the year barbed wire was invented. The sharp metal barbs tore the skin of the men who stretched it along fence tops, but they prevented cattle from pushing over the fences and destroying crops. New farm equipment was invented. This included a plow that could break up the grassland of the plains. And farmers learned techniques for farming in dry weather.
Most of the problems on the plains could be solved, but solving them cost money. A farmer could get wood to build his house, but he had to buy the wood and pay the railroad to bring it west. To farm the plains, he needed barbed wire for fences and plows and other new equipment. All these things cost money. So a plains farmer had to grow crops that were in big demand. He usually put all his efforts into producing just one or two crops.
The farmers of the plains did well at first. There was enough rain. Huge crops of wheat and corn were produced. Much of the grain was sold in Europe, and farmers got good prices. The farmers, however, were not satisfied. They were angry about several things. One was the high cost of sending their crops to market. The only way to transport their grain was by railroad, and railroad prices were very high for farm products, higher than for anything else. The railroads also owned the big buildings where grain was stored. Farmers had to pay to keep their grain there until it was sold. They said storage costs were too high.
The farmers were angry about the high cost of borrowing money, too. They opposed the import taxes, tariffs they had to pay on foreign products. Some of the tariffs were as high as 60%. Congress had set the levels high to protect American industry from foreign competition. But farmers said they were the victims of this policy because it increased their costs. Farmers as individuals could do nothing to change the situation. But if they united in a group, they thought, perhaps they could influence government policy.
Farmers began to unite in local social and cultural groups called Granges. As more and more farmers joined Granges, the groups began to act on economic problems. Farmers organized cooperatives to buy equipment and supplies in large amounts directly from factories. The cost of goods was lower when bought in large amounts. The Granges also began to organize for political action. Local Granges became part of the National Grange Movement. Grange supporters won control of state legislatures in a number of Middle Western states. They passed laws to limit the cost of railroad transportation and crop storage. Railroads refused to obey these laws. They fought the measures in the courts. They did not win. Finally, they appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
The railroads said the laws were not constitutional because they interfered with the right of Congress to control trade between the states. The railroads said states could not control transportation costs. To do so would reduce profits for the railroad, and that would be the same as taking property from the railroad without legal approval. The Supreme Court rejected this argument. In a decision in 1876, the Supreme Court said states had a legal right to control costs of railroad transportation. It said owners of property in which the public has an interest must accept public control for the common good. The farmers seem to have won, but the powerful railroad companies continued to struggle against controls. They reduced some transportation costs, but only after long court fights.
The Granges tried to get Congress to pass laws giving the federal government power to control the railroads. Congress refused to act. Many farmers lost hope that the Granges could force the railroads to make any real cuts in their costs. They began to leave the organization. Others left because the economy had improved. They no longer felt a need to protest. Within a few years, the National Grange had lost most of its members. Some local groups continued to meet, but they took no part in politics. New protest groups would be formed in a few years when farmers once again faced hard times. But for now, in the late 1870s, times were good. Most people were satisfied. We will continue this story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Steve Ember. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.